Izumi of Kyoshi Island was not a bender. Although the Order's founder had been the avatar of her era, none of her warriors had ever been benders. They were, for reasons no one was entirely sure of, vanishingly rare among the island's population. What she was, though, was a child, well, technically a great-grandchild, of harmonic convergence, able to count among her ancestors at least one of the denizens of the spirit world who had come to live in the mortal one after that seminal event. By this age, 120 years after the opening of the ways, about 0.1% of Dicho's human population could so describe themselves. The effects of being spirit-kin varied as much as the spirits themselves, and in Izumi's particular case, she had never experienced any identifiable benefit or drawback. It was just an interesting feature of her background, something to start conversations with on occasion. Until recently. Since she'd gone to Sephiro as part of Avatar Korra's honor guard, Izumi had noticed a change in her perception of the world. It was subtle at first, to the extent that she could convince herself she'd imagined it, but lately it had grown stronger and stronger until she could no longer deny that something was happening. Usually in her sleep, but of late, sometimes in waking life as well, she was getting flashes of the past, of other lives and times, and most recently of what she had come to realize was the future, or perhaps more than one possible future. It had all been terribly confusing, particularly as there was really no authority she could ask for advice on how to handle or interpret the visions. Korra might have been able to shed some light on the matter, she supposed, but it seemed like a terrible imposition, and besides, the Avatar was very busy and lived far away. Instead, Izumi had done some reading, and then a lot of meditating, until she had at last reached an imperfect but steadily improving state of détente with her new awareness. There was, after all, no great hurry. She was the youngest of the Kyoshi warriors, at least until the more promising of the current trainees earned their medallions, and with care and prudence she had a long career ahead of her in which to master this curious new faculty. Now, though, as she regarded the red-headed enemy with senses heightened for battle, Izumi suddenly realized that she had run out of time. All the possible futures were converging to the same outcome. Her painted lips quirked in a little smirk. Well then. Ignoring Maki's cries for her to flee, Izumi closed with Toga instead, circling him cautiously. He let her come, twirling his lightsaber in little circles so that it made a cruel-sounding snarl. "Your friend's right, you know," he said, his tone strangely conversational given the circumstances. "You can't take me all by yourself." With what she assumed he thought was an engaging smile, he went on, "There's no point in throwing your life away for people you hardly know." Izumi's response was a mirthless chuckle. "What would you know about what is and isn't worth dying for?" Then, shaking her head, she went on matter-of-factly, "You and I, Mr. Kiryu. Neither of us is leaving this place alive today." A microsecond pulse of shock crossed his face at the sound of his name, since he had no reason to think she might know it. And in that moment, Izumi burst into motion, charging toward him at a full-on sprint. Toga's face contorted in a sneer, the shock clearing, as he watched her come, then flashed out his scarlet light blade to intercept her. It appeared he could taste of the future as well. It was like a game of the Citadel version of Pai Sho, victory to the one who could see the most moves ahead. At the last possible instant, Izumi dropped into a slide, like a baseball player, the edge of her boot sole tearing at the frozen ground. Toga's saber passed over its intended target, her neck, and nicked a corner off her golden headdress. As she passed by him, she delivered a series of quick, sharp punches to his side, striking the chi points all up his right flank. 5 fast, evenly spaced strikes from belt to armpit. In a normal man, this maneuver, delivered with a mailed fist, would have rendered his right arm and leg useless for several minutes, as well as making it difficult to breathe or speak. Izumi was under no illusions that this was a normal man, though, and so she had taken out some insurance. As she completed the slide a few yards beyond him, sprang to her feet, and whirled to face him again, the kunai jutting between the second and third knuckles of her striking fist shed an arc of blackish blood onto the snow. In the half-second or so she had left before he struck her down, Izumi had the satisfaction of knowing that she had forced him to reveal his true face, and that it was just as ugly as she had thought it would be. Maki saw Izumi fall, saw the red-eyed, wolf-jawed, shadow-black thing that had been the enemy captain standing over her, and screamed. It was not a scream of fear, in spite of the enemy's monstrous transformation, for Maki was not the sort of woman to be fearful of monsters. Nor was it a scream of denial, for denial was futile in the face of fact, and futility was a waste of time. No, Maki's scream was an alloy of grief and pain and impotent fury, a primal human cry to some greater power for the strength to do something in redress of this terrible wrong. And, Dicho being the sort of world it was, some greater power answered. When it was all over, witnesses from both sides of the battle would swear that Maki's eyes went blank with light, the way the Avatars did when she called on the full power of the Avatar spirit. Straightening from her injured slump, she hurled away the blocks of stone that had imprisoned her, not with a sudden burst of superhuman physical strength, but with the percussive, open-handed gestures of an earthbender. Springing to her feet, she nearly fell as her right leg declined to bear more than the smallest fraction of her weight. Teeth gritted, she remained upright. Without making any effort to recover her dropped fans, she drew her katana instead. The thing that had been Toga noticed her movements, withdrew his lightsaber from Izumi's fallen body, and turned to face the new threat, his bestial face forming an echo of his sardonic smirk, warped by his new form but instantly recognizable. With a guttural snarl, he flourished the glowing blade, then dropped into a ready stance and made a taunting, "Come on, then," gesture with his free hand. He was probably expecting some kind of limping, hopping, one-and-a-half-legged charge. What he got instead was the ground beneath his opponent's booted feet, upheaving, carrying her toward him on the crest of a rippling wave, as though the ice and stone themselves were loyal to her, carrying her forward when her own legs couldn't do it. As she swept toward him, Maki changed her position, drawing back her sword to strike, and suddenly its blade was wreathed in yellow-orange flame. In that instant, Toga's infernal eyes perceived her as two figures, the battered young woman in the modern tactical gear, and superimposed upon her, in exactly the same stance, a taller, older woman in an elaborate, old-fashioned kimono, her long, grim face made up in the same style. He had thought the Kyoshi warrior's face paint rather silly at the start of this battle, but now the effect was chillingly purposeful. She struck with a cry like thunder, her flame-sheathed sword batting aside his lightsaber like an iron bar parries a stick, and as the tip of the blade touched his chest, the spirit imbuing her leapt through the sword and burned a hole straight through Toga, then tore his own dark spirit clean out of his dying shell and carried it along into the spirit world. Stunned by the intensity of what had just happened to her, Maki crumpled into Seiza in front of the smoking remains of her enemy. For a few seconds she just sat there, her eyes fixed sightlessly on an imponderable distance as the battle raged around her. She came back to herself with a cry of surprise as something warm and wet rasped against her cheek. Recoiling, she turned to see Neri, spattered with soot and blood, but evidently unharmed, regarding her with concern. Slowly and painfully, she pulled herself together and got to her feet, tentatively testing her right leg. It still hurt, but it would carry her now. Shaking herself, Maki bent and picked up her slain foe's weapon, hanging it on her tactical harness. No sense leaving it lying around for someone else to pick up. With one hand on Neri's flank for support, she limped out toward the boat dock to see what had become of Corwin. A short time earlier, at the top of the gatehouse, Utrina frowned. She wasn't sure what had happened at the back wall exactly, but the sudden destruction, disintegration, disappearance of their rear defenses had allowed a sizable group of black-clad attackers to swarm into the courtyard, several of whom had already begun to free Chang's traitors from the cuffs of ice and rock that they'd been placed into. "We're going to lose the courtyard," she realized aloud, "either to those guys or when they bust the gates open again and bring their friends in." Her attention was seized by a sudden flash of silver light from behind the citadel, followed by a thunderous boom rolling back across the ice pack. "Well, that'll be Corwin," she said, then turned to Anthy with a look of shock as she realized that the low-level lens contact she'd been maintaining with him had been severed. "I can't raise him," she said, dismay growing in her voice as she looked down at the rose-tinted gem on her wrist. "I don't think he can't be." Anthy took her husband's hand and squeezed it reassuringly. "He's alive. He wouldn't dare do otherwise." Utrina's face was ashen, but she managed a small smile for that. "Okay. But even if he's just down, getting all of us out of here on Vayu is that much harder. I don't think we can count that as a real plan anymore." Pursing her lips, Utrina looked at the situation one last time, then drew herself up, resolve bringing color back into her face and a flash of heat in her eyes. "All right, this is what we're going to do. Anthy, you, Garnet, and Nima head back to the keep and hole up in the most defensible room you can find. That storeroom we saw last night would probably work." "The storeroom's a good choice," Nima confirmed. "It's back right into the mountain to help keep it cool. Unless you're an earthbender, there's only one way in or out, and that approach isn't exactly stealthy." Utrina nodded. "Good. I'm going to join Kate in the courtyard. With the two of us, Surge, the Kyoshi warriors, and Neri, I think we can make a pretty solid stand." Anthy's eyes flashed with anger. "We're outnumbered 10-1. I will not hide in the back while other people fight. Not when I can make a difference. Never again!" Utrina reached out, putting a hand on either of her shoulders. "Anthy, this isn't about hiding. It's about protecting. If they get through us, what happens to Annabelle?" That brought Anthy up short, her anger clearing, though her voice was still thick with emotion. "That still doesn't change the fact that we're in serious trouble. You need every hand that can help." Utrina took a hand off of Anthea's shoulder, turning her wrist and letting her sleeve fall back to reveal her lens again. "That's why I'm calling for backup." Anthea considered that, then finally stepped back, bowing her head for a moment before speaking. "I understand. I don't like it, but..." She looked to Nima, who offered a nod. "We'll manage." As it happened, Utrina didn't have a chance to call for backup right away. As she had predicted, the situation in the courtyard rapidly degenerated. Though she had destroyed the controls for the powered gates, the enemy had enough manpower on the wrong side of them thanks to their postern breach that they were able to muscle them open by main force, and there was nothing the overstretched defenders could do to stop them. Utrina took what control of the situation she could, rallying the defenders and concentrating them in the area just in front of the keep, where they could form a salient of sorts. But doing so meant she was too busy to conduct a lens conversation. About the only upside to it all that Utna could see was that she, too, received some unexpected reinforcements. As the defenders fell back, a party of men and women in what looked to be some sort of naval uniform entered from the demolished boat dock. Their leader, a young woman who looked not entirely unlike Cora, spotted Utna and made straight for her, then squared up and saluted. "Lieutenant Kava, Southern Water Tribe Navy," she said. Without really thinking about it, Utna replied, "Captain Utna Tenjo, IPSF." "Captain Oktuluk of the Kilinik sends his regards, ma'am," said the lieutenant. "Our ship's got the fjord bottled up in case they've got other naval assets out there, but our guns aren't going to do you a lot of good in a confined space like this, so he wonders if you might have a use for a few more hands." Utna cracked her first, and, she expected, probably last, smile of the battle. "Lieutenant, you better believe it." Kava gave a tight little smile in return, her blue eyes twinkling, then turned to her shore party and barked, "All right, you heard the lady. Fall in!" "Okay, listen up, people. I haven't got a lot of time here," Utna said to the newly augmented defenders as they gathered. "Those four people in the fancy armor? Very, very bad news. Their armor's magic. It's basically indestructible, so don't waste your time. Stay clear of them and focus on the triad mooks and the people in the black uniforms. Has anyone seen Maki?"
"I'm here, Utna," said Maki, limping into the line with Neri behind her.
Utna felt a surge of relief as she saw that the polar bear dog had a couple of figures slung on her back. She had no idea who the girl with the blue hair was, but the other was Corwin, and though unconscious, he was plainly not dead.
"What happened here?" she wondered as she helped Maki get him down.
"Not sure," Maki replied. "I think the girl has something to do with the sub Corwin sank, but I didn't see what actually happened."
"Where's Izumi?" Utna asked, but Maki just shook her head, her eyes like flint.
Understanding without another word, Utna silently gave the warrior's armored shoulder a squeeze, then set to work consolidating their position. Working quickly in the face of the approaching enemy, they lay Corwin gently down at the back of the formation, near the stairs, where a couple of White Lotus waterbender medics were tending to the wounded. Then, for lack of any better ideas, they put the girl in the pea jacket next to him. As satisfied as they could be under the circumstances, they went back into the line.
"You ready for this?"
Utna asked quietly, as the four Machaux broke into a run halfway across the courtyard and led their second wave of minions in a charge. Caitlin smiled a mirthless little smile.
"I'll try to leave a few for you," she said, and then, as far as virtually everyone on both sides of the battle line could see, she disappeared.
Moments after Caitlin vanished, the vanguard of the Black Rose's charge came within shouting distance. At the head of the pack, Anubishu drew his nodachi with one hand, then pointed directly at the pink-haired woman leading the defenders with his offhand's bladed gauntlet.
"Overwhelm them and break through, but their leader is mine."
"Well," Utna mused to herself, "I guess I know who my dance partner is."
Bringing her sword up in the briefest of mock salutes to the Kanikan leader, she threw herself at him with a wordless cry of defiance, meeting his charge as the other attackers made way. Caitlin had no illusions, pardon the expression, that her power to cloud the minds of men would hide her from Rajara. Like the classic force persuasion technique popularly known as the Jedi mind trick, it worked best on those with weak wills or dull senses, and whatever else he was, Rajara wasn't either of those things. That was fine, though. She wasn't really trying to hide from him. It was his backup, the Triad and Black Rose foot soldiers, she was interested in. Invisible to the vast majority of them, she scythed through their ranks like a cold wind.
not going out of her way to engage any of them, but making a straight run for the magenta-clad warlord. Any who happened to stand between them went down, painfully but temporarily incapacitated, by precise blows from her still-enclosed Zatoichi. As she had expected, he saw her coming. She couldn't see much of his expression past the menpo of his armor. Its elaborate demon grimace hid all but his eyes. Or, well, eye. He only had the right one. On Ishiyama, legend had it, he'd sacrificed the left for the power to see through his own illusions. The one he had narrowed at her approach with something of a glint of satisfaction in it. She surprised him, though, by expecting him to see her. Rather than make a direct attack that would have run her straight into his array of scythes, Kate changed course at the last moment and knocked down a couple of clueless Agni Kai soldiers to give herself more room to work. "Ah, of course," said Rajara, his tone complimentary but mocking, as he turned to face her. "You always were the tactician of the duelists, though, weren't you? Yamao underestimated you, years ago." His eye went cold, reptilian, as he added flatly, "I won't." "You just did," Kate thought, as, through the force, she felt the ripple of psychic energy that presaged the weaving of one of Rajara's illusions. She assumed he was going to try to make her see one of her own teammates in his place, and or take someone on her side for him, secure in the knowledge that, like most martial artists, she was dependent on her eyes to fight. Smiling another cold little smile, she reached up with her free hand and took off her spectacles. Ordinarily, that was not a terribly helpful thing to do, since it meant her hyperopia reduced everything within a few yards to a meaningless blur. But Kate seemed quite pleased with the result. With a sound of evident satisfaction, she tucked the glasses away in her parka and carried on without them. "What the devil are you doing?" the warlord demanded, his tone now somewhere between mocking and indignant. "I'm going to assume, given the state of relations between Morita and Kaneko, that you've never seen any of my films," Kate replied as she advanced slowly toward him, her lips still curled in that same small, icy smile. Drawing her blade, she reversed it in her hand, the way she held it as Ichi, and went on, "You see, I'm a method actor." With the two most senior of the Masho taking the greatest challenges on the field, as was their right, Naza found himself uninterested in what he saw as lesser opponents. He lacked Anubishu's zealous hatred of this place, or Rajara's delight in the massive deception. He was simply doing his duty. And that left him with his totem's rather torpid outlook as he swept through the compound, occasionally battering the few White Lotus benders who attempted to attack him rather than simply fleeing from their betters.
"Pathetic,"
he spat, scanning the grounds.
"These are barely worth my time."
Then he paused as his golden eyes settled on a pair of forms who had been tucked against the side of the keep beneath survival blankets, with what looked like a hastily constructed rampart of ice and rocks to protect them from being trampled accidentally. The woman who had been serving as Toga's lackey was of no real interest to him, but the inert form of Corwin Ravenhair was another matter entirely. He hadn't been present for the Masho's original engagement with the duelists in Sendai, but as Caitlin's brother and the equally hated Griffin's son, he was a juicy target regardless of Otori's plans. Besides, revenge on an unsuspecting foe was something that Naza could always get behind. Striding toward the little shelter, the warlord whirled one of his katana through a brief flourish, shedding flecks of blood from the blade. Not really addressing his unconscious target in a mocking undertone, he muttered,
"I'll do you a favor, boy, and make this quick. I'm sure it will be far kinder than anything that demon had planned for you."
He was preparing to leap the barricade that separated him from his prey when a white, shaggy thing burst up from it, howling a challenge as it slammed into him hard enough to send him sprawling backward. Thrown back by the impact, Naza stumbled briefly before going to one knee to collect himself and get a look at what had interrupted him. He'd been shown a picture of this beast, hadn't he? Ah, yes, the Avatar's pet. The polar bear dog looked a bit the worse for wear. Her coat was dirty, matted in places by a combination of ashy soot and the unmistakable color of drying blood. As she took up a protective stance, a seismic growl of warning rumbling from her throat.
The pet protects its master's boy. How touching.
Smirking beneath the menpo of his yoroi, his eyes glittered with anticipation.
I'll deal with you as well, and make the wound we'll leave in the Avatar's heart fester all the more.
He had no idea if the beast had understood him, but she certainly recognized his intent. Her growl changed to a fierce snarl before the beast charged again. Naza had intended to simply brace himself and let the animal learn that she had no hope of doing any damage against his armor, but soon realized the flaw in his plan. Even if the polar bear dog's claws and teeth were ineffective, the man inside was still capable of being knocked around quite badly by a beast that weighed well over 900 pounds. When he finally was able to get some distance between them, the warlord's vision was swimming thanks to several blows from Neri's massive paws, and he could taste the coppery tang from where he'd bitten the inside of his own mouth. As he spat a long stream of blood, the serpent's eyes were flared with anger.
Enough of this! I won't be defeated by a mere dog, no matter how big you are.
Facing Neri as she slowly stalked toward him, teeth bared, Naza set himself, then began to draw the blades secured at either side of his waist, as he called upon his armor's magic. Whirling the swords through the air so quickly that they seemed to form a chain, each blade began to glow a deep crimson as his power imbued them with deadly venom.
Six-headed serpent!
His attempt to use his ultimate attack had been shockingly interrupted by the feeling that a massive vise had clamped onto his hand, sending the swords clattering along the ground. Turning in response to this painful intrusion, he saw his hand wrapped within the embrace of dark, lustrous stone, and Sayanji's little pet staring at him like something he'd found beneath his boot. Have I mentioned that I really don't like you guys? Anakin Skywalker released the warlord's hand, then cranked back and slammed the hand of Wrath's massive fist into Naza's chest, sending him flying backward. Drawing himself up to one knee with a snarl, Naza steadied himself, trying to catch his breath and get a handle on his fight that had suddenly gone so dramatically off the rails. He flexed his hand and found it intact, though sore. His yoroi had protected him as ever.
So, you finally show your true colors, boy.
Skywalker shrugged as he began to circle the warlord carefully, watching for his next move. It's not my fault you haven't been paying attention. Naza didn't respond to that with words. Instead, he made a lunging dive toward his discarded weapons, then sprang back to his feet with a katana in each hand, their blades beginning to glow once again with his poisonous power. Drawing his greatsword off of his back with the hand of Wrath, Anakin ignited his lightsaber with the other, and it was time for round two. Back at the aid station, Sergei considered joining in, but Neri and the newcomer seemed to have the situation well in hand, so he decided against it. Better to stay here and cover the defensive point more closely while they dealt with the armored enemy. After all, someone might spot the opening provided by their having been drawn off and seek to capitalize on it. Someone like a particularly bold Black Rose student, for instance, who was now edging around the packed snow battlement that surrounded the station, his weapon in hand. Milos Rodzinski had no particular investment in doing harm to the injured defenders, not out of the goodness of his heart, but because it wasn't his job. However, it had occurred to him that there might be a reward, or at least some points, in it for him if he were to recover the late Administrator Kiryu's captured assistant. Spying her stretched out under a foil blanket by the wall, Rozhansky moved forward. She wasn't very big. He could sling her over his shoulder and then make for one of the contingency escape routes. Who knew? Maybe she'd be grateful for the rescue. Or maybe someone back at the Otori Institute would be. Either way worked for Rozhansky. That was his plan right up until the moment when the tiger and the severe-looking girl in the face paint blocked his path, anyway.
"Leave," said the painted girl flatly. "Now, son," the tiger's eerily intelligent golden eyes seemed to be adding. Rozhansky left. With a sigh, Maki put a hand on Serge's head and rubbed the nearer of his ears.
"Grum,"
he agreed, and they continued their vigil in silence. Shuten Doji didn't realize that his newfound nemesis from the Otori Institute had joined the battle on the side of his enemies. If he had, he would have rejoiced and joined battle instantly. Instead, he was left scuffling around, abandoned by the other Masho, trying to find some sort of worthy opponent. Anubishu had claimed the pink-haired girl who appeared to lead the duelists as his own. Rajara was off somewhere destroying the mind of her mousy friend, the one who had slain Yamao, even though Shuten now bore Yamao's armor, and thus should rightfully have had the fighting of her. Naza, snake that he was probably poisoning the wounded and laughing to himself, his sibilance drooling out the side of his mouth like venom. As if in answer to his wish, Shuten realized that he could see the woman who had apparently bested Toga through the melee, but his heart sank when he drew closer. She was at the makeshift aid station the defenders had set up, sporting an obvious splint on her right leg and using her sheathed sword as an improvised crutch.
Pah!
He was impressed at her apparent ability. Kiryu was an ass and a womanizer who he had little use for, but he did have some skill with a blade. All the same, though she might have been able to defeat the demon, she was wounded now, and there would be no honor in challenging her in that condition. His sense of honor was, it seemed, the only thing left to him. Between the abuse he had suffered at the hands of the other Masho and the sense of decay that surrounded the Order of the Black Rose, he felt adrift, unable to find a true reason to fight. He wasn't even sure why the Masho were participating in this battle. But his was the armor of the Oni Masho. He had his orders, and he would serve his master of the moment by destroying any opponent worthy of facing him, then rain down destruction upon these pitiful... An invisible hand slapped him to the ground. He'd barely had time to make a noise of utter confusion when that same force lifted him up from the ground, then flung him against one of the thick outcroppings of rock that one of the many earthbenders had raised during the battle, slamming him against it hard enough to drive the wind out of his lungs in an explosive gasp. When the youngest of the Masho finally managed to focus on anything other than attempting to breathe again, he gaped in surprise at the black-clad figure who stood there, one hand outstretched, the other resting at the hilt of his lightsaber.
"You are still too predictable," Kyuichi Sayonji said, his voice thick with anger. "And now you were going to attack an already injured woman? Prey on what you believed was the weakest target?"
The green-haired samurai's hand tightened into a fist, then he flung his arm sharply out to the side, sending Shuten hurtling into the side of one of the compound's satellite buildings, hard enough that he bounced with a painful-sounding crack before hitting the ground again.
"You had potential, Shuten. You might have become something better. Instead, you fight on a world where you have no place for a master who has no honor."
With the distinctive snap hiss of ignition, Sayonji drew his lightsaber, bringing it above his head in a high guard stance. "You and the other Masho have become worse than nothing. You've become a waste." Released from the samurai's grip,
Shuten rose with a cry of outrage. Worthless traitor! I fight only those worthy to cross blades with a Masho, not the helpless and injured. Unlike you, I keep my honor and my loyalty to my master, and I will prove them both by destroying you! Sionji's eyebrows rose. Perhaps he had misjudged Shuten, and there was something worth saving in this particular Masho? Letting the boy charge him, all temper and no finesse, Sionji simply leapt past his first bull rush of an attack, landing with his back to the same building he'd just bounced the boy off of. Extending his free hand, his fingers twitched up, his mouth turning to a dark, taunting smile. Perhaps if he laid waste to Shuten once and for all, the boy would learn something, just as Sionji once had. With that in mind, he uttered the trademark words of the master who had begun his own breaking and remaking. Bring it. The bitterly amusing highlight of Caitlin's battle with the demon general of illusion came when, having at last gotten his head around the idea that his opponent had abandoned the use of her eyes and was still able to fight him quite effectively, he turned to auditory illusions. As far as he was concerned, the voices and sound effects were usually just tinsel, the finishing touches on his visual masterpieces. Now he was having to rely on them solely to try and trip up and misdirect his silent, relentless foe, and it wasn't working. The thing that gave Kate such darkly amused satisfaction about that was her reasonable certainty that Rajara would never understand why pleading for her to cease her attack in Utena's voice hadn't worked. He might possess the sorcerer's power to warp the visual perceptions of anyone around him. He might even be able to create convincing sound effects and voices to go along with them. But it never seemed to occur to him that, with Kate's glasses off, his illusions were the only things she could see clearly. Everything else, coming in through her flawed eyes, was blurred, but the illusions, created out of whole cloth by his psychic interference in her head, were crystal clear. That in itself made it very simple for her to tell what was real and what was not, soundtrack notwithstanding. But beyond that, it was evident from the way Rajara conducted himself that he was entirely ignorant of the Force. Even if it was explained to him, he would never be able to grasp the idea that Kate, even with eyes closed, as they often were, since even clearly identifiable, the illusions were a bit distracting, and from 50 yards away, knew exactly where Utena was. Hell, with her aura at fighting pitch and her heart filled with the fury of a woman defending her family, Utena's was the easiest presence to sense in the whole compound. Which was not to say, even so, that fighting him was easy. Even with his most potent weapon rendered useless, Rajara was an extremely skillful swordsman, and he still had the undeniable advantage of his unbreachable armor. It took all of Caitlin's skill, and a good proportion of her stamina, to keep up with him, let alone edge ahead. If she'd had time to consider it, she'd have ranked him in the top 3 or 4 opponents she'd ever had to face. He might even have been as strong as Yamao, who had been the most senior and experienced of the Masho when they had crossed paths with the duelists the first time, on that years-ago Christmas in Sendai. Of course, Caitlin had defeated him, too. She still remembered how it had felt, that yawning instant when the Force and her own ki had aligned, perfectly positioning her to strike at the weakest point of the old master's yoroi. Monday, December 25th, 2406. Sendai, Ishiyama. Yamao realized his mistake an instant after he made it. Moving with preternatural speed and sureness, the duelist child eluded the red lightning, flitting from gap to gap amid the leaping forest of chains as if guided by some invisible hand, streaking toward him like a missile. As the moment elongated, the Masho commander saw tears glittering in the air, trailing from the corners of her wide, wrathful, anguished eyes. Silent throughout the battle, she now uttered a long, wordless scream, lips drawn back from her teeth, hating what she was about to do, knowing she had no choice but to do it, if she wished to save herself and her friends. furious with him for forcing her into this place, where the only course left open to her was to take his life. Trapped in the midst of his failed ultimate attack, unable to do anything now but let it run its course, Yamao closed his eyes and accepted his fate.
"Well played, child," he thought,
and then the duelist's sword passed through the minuscule gap below his outstretched right arm like a key sliding into a lock. There wasn't even any pain to speak of, just a curious sense of cold, like a draft, and then nothing. Caitlin withdrew her crimson-streaked sword from her foe's body and let him fall, clattering dead weight, to the frozen ground of Sakura's family's courtyard. For a moment she stood over the corpse, breathing hard, the tears still streaming down her face. Her hands wanted to tremble. Instead, she made them clean the blade and put it away. Then, tearing her eyes away from what remained of the first thinking being she'd ever had to kill, she made for the house, knowing that her day's work was far from over, hoping against hope that the dying, at least, was done. It occurred to Kate to wonder, as that memory raced across her mind, why she wasn't having a similar reaction to the inevitable end of her battle with Rajara. She knew full well, after all, that this, like that, was a fight to the death. Rajara was a psychopathic killer bent on her destruction and that of everything she loved. He would never surrender, and given his armor, it was unlikely that she'd be able to disable him without killing him outright. Barring truly extraordinary circumstances that showed no sign of developing, there were only two ways this thing was going to end, with his extinction or her own, and she had absolutely no intention of dying today, so that left him. She realized that, and it suddenly occurred to her that that didn't bother her. Why is that? She wondered, in that part of her mind that always had time to consider these things, no matter what the rest of her was doing. Had her heart hardened to such an extent between the ages of 17 and 21 that she no longer cared about the implications of taking a man's life? Was it true what they said, that killing got easier the more you did it, to the point where it might eventually become something of a habit? After much consideration, she decided that no, that wasn't it. She still didn't want to kill the man. But she had accepted, on a level deeper than reasoned understanding, that he needed killing. And the unpleasant task had fallen to her. It was as simple as that. Rajara had no idea what his opponent had been considering in that brief pause, but he was able to sense her instant of hesitation, perhaps a weakening of her resolve. Despite the bizarre, though he would admit effective, defense she had used against his powers, she had finally succumbed to his webs of deception, as so many others had before her, and that, he was supremely confident, would be her downfall. Whirling the linked scythes from the back of his yoroi, Rajara spun his weapon through a wide flourish, then swept it forward. The dark magic at his command turned each blade's handle into an independent weapon, spinning through the air at the blinded swordswoman, his voice carried along with them, echoing from every direction in a weird, slightly out-of-sync stereo.
"Spiderweb cast!"
The flying blades and their illusory shadows would have slashed a normal opponent to ribbons, the victim unaware which was real and which a phantom until the moment they drew blood. The perfect, inevitable end to any who challenged the Masho's chief strategist. Caitlin Hutchins was anything but a normal opponent. From her moment of realization, she had settled into herself, opening herself completely to the Force. Letting it guide her, she could feel the ripples around her from the Yoroi's magic as it attempted to warp her perceptions, and the whispered warnings that separated the true threats from the harmless shadows. Dropping to one knee to avoid the initial strike, she sprang upward, blade sweeping before her to deflect away another of the warlord's scythes. Charging forward, her hands moving almost of their own volition, switching her blade from the reversed grip she'd used through their battle to the style she normally used in Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu, then drew upon the same powerful serenity to fuel her counterattack.
Senken no Arashi!
Much like the warlord's ultimate attack, the duelist's weapon seemed to multiply as her arms moved with impossible speed, cutting the air with a thrumming buzz as she closed the distance between them. But where Rajara's magic had filled the air with illusory, essentially harmless copies of his weapons, the force fueled Caitlin's attacks, propelling them at superhuman speed. And as the strikes of the Thousand-Blade Storm began to slash at the gaps and soft joints in his armor, Rajara was shocked to learn that each one was very, very real. The protection of his mystic armor prevented the strikes from cutting deeply, but each bled, and each sent whispered shocks of pain through him as he became overwhelmed by the seemingly endless strikes. Guided through the attack, Caitlin could feel the warlord's defenses crumble, and a sense of finality as the force carried her into a follow-through, free hand outstretched, blade hand drawn back above her head and a ready guard. Moving with a deadly, effortless grace, her legs flexed, knees bent, and she suddenly lunged forward. Her free hand collided with the dazed warlord's armored sternum, rocking him backward, and putting him into the perfect position for Kotetsu no Sasayaki to thrust forward through his helmet's menpo, impaling Rajara through the empty socket of his missing eye.
This cannot, he thought, and then Caitlin had slain two of the invincible Masho of Kaneko.
As she had over Yamao, so she stood over Rajara's remains for a moment, catching her breath. But this time there were no tears, no trembling hands. When she cleaned her blade and sheathed it, she felt a stab of pain in her right forearm. Kate felt at the arm and realized that, sometime during the battle, it had been broken. Such was her focus at the time that she hadn't even noticed. Putting her glasses back on, she bent and took the sash from around the waist of the nearest unconscious white lotus, wrapping it around her arm and neck in an improvised sling. Then, with a deep intake of breath, she turned and re-entered the overall fray. Sneering, Anubishu laughed as the pink-haired duelist spent herself against him. She was a skilled swordswoman and a bold opponent, there was no denying that. But she was also hopelessly outclassed, and to persevere in the face of that, as far as Anubishu was concerned, made her a fool.
"You're done, Prince Tenjo," he declared. "This battle is ours, and no weapon you carry is strong enough to pierce the yoroi."
Ichina could feel the burn in her muscles and the aches from where she'd taken grazing cuts from his blade, or scrapes from the spikes of the warlord's mystic armor. He was right about one thing. The Black Rose seemed to be winning by sheer weight of numbers. The turncoat lotuses were mostly defeated, but it seemed like every time she turned around, more and more of those kids in weird mirror universe versions of the old Otori Academy uniforms kept showing up. "Maybe I can't cut straight through," she thought, "but every armor has weaknesses, and so does the person wearing it." Going to one knee, Utrina let the point of the blade that Corwin had given her rest against the snowpack. Her eyes locked in on the warlord's, waiting to see just what he would do. Taking her move as a sign of submission, Anabishu's smile turned cruel.
"Pathetic. I had thought that you would have given me a worthwhile battle, but it seems that we'll have to simply offer your corpse to Yamao's memory."
Raising his nodachi, the leader of the Masho called upon his power, wrapping the weapon in shadowy energy and filling the air with a hissing crackle.
"Time to die! Darkness slash!"
As the warlord brought the blade down, cleaving the snowy ground with an impossibly wide slash of black lightning, Uchina acted. Throwing herself into a diving roll, she came up under the strike, then popped herself up, driving the ancient blade upwards with all her momentum and the weight of her body behind it as she began to glow with rose-tinted energy. Her strike was aimed with precision, the edge of her blade cleaving through Anavishu's wrist at the gap between his armored forearm and gauntlet. The craftsmen who made the yoroi, and the sorcerers who laid its ancient enchantments, were skilled and powerful indeed, but they were not of Ivaldi the Ancient's caliber, and the armor's joints could not resist a strike from one of his masterpieces, delivered with such a mixture of precision and passion by one of the Disir. The hand, still gripping his sword, went spinning away, surrounded by a sputtering nimbus of failing magic. As he dropped to his knees from a combination of the pain and his sudden loss of balance, the warlord's eyes were wide with shock, his remaining hand automatically going to the bloody stump in an attempt to slow the bleeding.
"Impossible! Not even a lightsaber can cut through the yoroi. How?"
Looking up, as if to find answers, the demon general of darkness found only a slim white fist wrapped around the hilt of a blade rushing toward his face, and he knew no more. Utna stood over his crumpled form for a moment, then turned and took a fast but hard look around. For the moment, the flow of the battle had moved away. Presumably, the Black Rose had wanted to give Anubishu at work as wide a berth as possible. So she finally had a little space and time to breathe, but not a lot. "It'll have to be enough," she thought, and then concentrated on her lens. "Cora, remember when you said it'd be best not to call unless it's an emergency? Well, boy howdy." Republic City. The Red Monsoon warehouse, by this point, had seen better days. Shelving and storage crates were twisted and shattered all over the main floor, where it wasn't fractured from the police's impromptu earthbending, and several tanks of water had ruptured as both the monsoons and the waterbending members of the Special Tactics Division and the Triples had vied for dominance over the essential element. Add to that the firepower that both sides were throwing around, and it wasn't a good idea to be out of cover for very long. With that in mind, at the first touch of lens communication, Cora had ripped up part of the flooring to make a serviceable firebreak and ducked behind it, quickly joined by Wakaba Shinohara, Inspector Imanishi, and Emily Wong. With Emily concentrating on maintaining the barrier, Cora and Wakaba were able to spare the cycles to respond. "What's the situation, Ujna?" Cora inquired, ducking down further as a bolt of lightning thrown by one of the Agni Kais cracked above their heads.
"It's kind of tight up here, but we've got them on the ropes."
"Really?"
"Yeah, and you were saying that before the Magna suits showed up, Cora," Wakaba interjected. "Still not feeling it."
"In that case, you're doing better than we are," Utrina admitted, her mental tone grave, cutting off any further attempts at levity. There is being, an attack on the compound. We don't know exactly why, but the Black Rose has shown up with the Masho from Kaneko, and Corwin's... he did something, but it took him out of the battle. We've already had casualties. Izumi's one of them." The two lenswomen's eyes widened.
"What the hell?" Wakaba replied, and glanced at Cora.
"The only people I can think of who'd want to piss on Corwin's birthday like that are on a very short list. How'd they even know where to find you guys?"
"Well, the White Lotus let them in. I would assume they also provided directions," Utrina replied with steel in her voice. "Hang a left at the glacier, you can't miss it. We'll leave the light on for you."
Beside them, Imanishi and Emily had no idea what was going on. The Avatar and the IPO agent seemed to be having some kind of silent conversation, but how and with whom they couldn't tell. But it was obvious to both of them that it wasn't good news, whatever it was. The two women's body language made that abundantly clear. Cora stiffened at the sickening implications of Utrina's remark. "An inside job." With a snarl, she earthbent a chunk of concrete and flung it into the general melee, taking out one of the red monsoons who were trying to flank them. "I'll ask who and why later. How long can you all hold out?"
"I have no idea how much longer this will go on, but there's a ton of Black Rose scrubs and triad goons remaining,
and at least two of them are show unaccounted for. I've put one out of action, and... She hesitated, then went bluntly on. I'm pretty sure Kate's killed one. Anthea and Nima are bunkered down in the keep, but they may just wear us down by sheer weight of numbers. Utrina paused. Wakaba and Korra couldn't see her, of course, but through the psychic link they had the distinct impression that she'd broken off to deal with an attacker. After a moment she came back and continued, I'm not sure what they want, but they want it real bad, whatever it is. We'll hold them as long as we can, but I don't know how long that'll be. Corbin's out of action, Izumi's dead, Maki and Kate are both injured, we're getting pretty frayed around the edges here. Any chance you can break away from the action up there? Korra's expression went grim and her body tensed. Give me a moment. We'll be there as soon as we're able. Without waiting for a reply, she cut the lens connection. Ignoring Imanishi and Emily's questions, she closed her eyes, and when she reopened them, they were filled with the light of the Avatar state. With a polyphonic cry of defiance, Korra rose to her feet, grabbed the upper edges of the barrier, and launched herself up and over and into the fray. Fort Tonrock. It took Sionji rather longer to administer the beatdown to Shuten than it had taken Caitlin to deliver his own, but then Caitlin had not had to deal with magic armor or the occasional minions who came to her opponent's aid. As Sionji was not interested in actually killing anyone who did not deserve it, and he knew just how misguided many of the Black Rose's younger students were, so they didn't, he had to pay rather more attention to them than he might have otherwise wished. Initially, Shuten seemed to have no compunctions about damaging them, however, so they were frequently scattered by the chain attacks from his red lightning. However, as the battle went on and the wounded began to pile up around them, he seemed to notice Sionji's consideration. And with that awareness, his certainty in his own cause wavered for the first time, the fury dying down a notch in his eyes.
"They are cannon fodder, traitor," Shuten sneered, trying to pull himself together. "And yet you waste your attention on them, when rightly you should be focusing on me."
He flung his chain at Sionji's head, tangling it around the lightsaber briefly, before Sionji sidestepped and slipped his weapon free. Those words sound like a parody of Anubishu, Sionji observed dispassionately. Or Naza. Did you learn it from him? Shuten's eyes flickered. They have given you their loyalty, and you repay them by harming them with attacks meant for me. Shuten's next strike went wide, and Sionji smiled inside to himself. Loyalty. That appeared to be the key to the young man's focus. Interesting. It explained why Shuten had not long ago told the other warlords what they could do with their poisonous attitudes. He countered, lunging forward with an acrobatic leap that owed more to his time training with the Sith than anything from Asagiri, Katsujin, Kenryu. And they clashed again, lightsaber on chain, then lightsaber on Kusari. The noise was terrible and left an acrid smoke in the air that clouded everything.
I will best you, Shuten growled through his mask. I will show honor to the armor I wear, to all who have worn it before me, and all who will wear it after me.
He struck again with his chain, tripping Sionji for once as the green-haired man's mind raced, struggling to find the right words to pierce Shuten's mental rather than physical armor.
So, it is to the spirit of your predecessor that you feel bound to serve? He inquired, rolling to his feet. Or is it to your armor? It cannot be to Kaneko, the Imperium has no jurisdiction here, and your servitude to Akio Otori is only a transient thing. Serving him will lead you only to ruin, as you must have seen with so many others.
But you serve him, Shuten countered, lunging forward to clash his kusari against Sionji's lightsaber a hair too late to catch him off balance.
I once served him, long ago, Sionji admitted, pressing back against the young man's armor-enhanced strength, then disengaging with a kick and a leap.
Out of a misguided sense of what he stood for, and it did indeed lead to my own ruin. I came back to try to rescue another from his corruption. My own act of misguided loyalty, perhaps. Shuten's eyes widened above the mask of his helmet, and he snarled something incoherent under his breath. But whatever it was, it lacked the heat of his previous fervor, and Saionji, sensing in that instant an opening, swung his lightsaber forward on the attack. Rather than catching it on his blade this time, Shuten caught it on one vambrace in preparation for some intended strike, but the armor distracted him as it gave off an alarming cracking sound. His eyes widened further, and for an instant Saionji sensed his opponent was panicking. The Masho armor did not crack. The Masho armor was impervious to harm. Except, perhaps, when the man wearing it lost his convictions? He'd been unable to save Toga, though at this point he didn't know just how complete that failure was. Perhaps he could save another misguided young red-haired man in his place. His lightsaber whirled, striking a dozen places, and though Shuten struggled to catch them on his kusari, his armor continued to make alarming noises, and he backpedaled, trying to gain himself enough ground to regroup. Saionji stretched his hand out and slapped downward, and the force responded, crushing down on the young warlord, who, though he let loose with a ki that would do any master proud, could not withstand the weight. He buckled to his knees, struggling with all his might, and Saionji lunged forward, striking with the point of his saber. But where he would have gone for the chest if this were a rose duel, he struck for the young man's face, at the bridge of his nose. With an ear-splitting screech, the lightsaber struck, held for a moment, and then the helmet split. Shuten's red hair spilled out in the icy wind of the battlefield, as he stared at the weapon that hovered a millimeter away from cleaving his skull. Above the point of the blade, a single kanji formed of glowing light. Loyalty, Saionji said, unsurprised, as he drew back and extinguished his lightsaber. There is something still worthwhile in you, Shuten Doji. Choose yourself a better master than you have done before now, and perhaps you will regain the virtue of your armor. While your loyalties are fractured, so too will your soul and your skill be. Open the eyes of your heart. Shuten's bleak mortal eyes rose to Saionji's, and then past him a silent explosion of light, dozens of times brighter than the already astonishing aurora, filled the sky to the west. Saionji turned, glanced back at Shuten once, and began to run toward the light. Behind him, Shuten rose slowly to his feet, holding his weapons loosely and staring about like a man completely lost. Then, turning, he trudged aimlessly away into the tundra, abandoning the field of this lost battle and vanishing in a whirl of wind-blown snow.